for me to be able to give a talk here at the Perimeter Institute, such a superb institution where theoretical physicists can pursue the most fundamental problems uninhibited and unquestioned. In this sense, it's really a rare pearl in a big sea. Having said that, it seems almost a sacrilege not giving a full-fledged blackboard talk, for which I apologize. But I brought the paper with me I'm going to discuss today, so if need be, we can talk on the blackboard as well. So this is work I was doing while I was still a postdoc at the University of Texas, so it includes my collaborators, Paul Shapiro and his graduate student, Bohua Li. And now I'm in Michigan, Ann Arbor, as David mentioned. And I'm going to talk about our recent work. So, right, I mean, cosmology these days, after Planck, not too many surprises. We have the concordance model of cosmology, where we have dark matter, which is cold on large scales, and baryons and radiation, and dark energy, which currently fits the observations very well if you think it's a cosmological constant. So this six-parameter base lambda CDM model remains the best fit model. Concordance, well, yeah, but if general relativity remains unchallenged, what is the dark matter and the dark energy? And all candidates for dark matter are beyond the standard model, and none of them have been detected. And the dark energy in its equation of state, which is a negative pressure, is even more weird, and it's even more unclear probably what this is. And certainly, a unified theory of all fundamental forces should eventually predict these things, which has been only inferred from astronomical observations originally. But since we don't have this yet, we have to refer to phenomenology. And I'm only talking about dark matter here, basically, in this talk. And these are just a few slides to remind people. Of course, I don't really need to, but never mind. What do we do in phenomenology? Of course, a lot of theories, models beyond the standard model, even if they're not a UV completion, they predict some good candidates for dark matter. The WIMPs, you know, supersymmetric models, for example, axions, stereoneutrinos. On the other hand, we have astronomical observations, and we do model astrophysical systems in n-body simulations, and those can constrain the macroscopic properties of dark matter. And for example, ruling out certain other candidates like neutrinos, because as I will point out later a little, the way the structures form in the universe would look differently if you had a hot dark matter like neutrino as your major component. Well, if these things would be in conflict with each other, particle theories these days are really inventive to try to implement more phenomenology without challenging successes. So you could, for example, think about models where you have self-interacting dark matter and still preserve a WIMP miracle and all these things. So if in conflict with each other, are they in conflict with each other? Well, not on a big scale, of course. I mean, we know that the primordial temperature of dark matter in the end determines the size of structure, of the smallest structures you receive in the late universe. So observation of the cosmic web down to dwarf galaxies suggests that dark matter has to be cold, non-relativistic, so it has no pressure on large scales. So this collisionless non-interacting CDM, along with the nearly scaling independent primordial power spectrum predicted from inflation or maybe other models, but let's say inflation is sort of the standard law, provides a well-accepted scenario for structure formation. Dark matter clusters hierarchically to form bigger structures, and the baryons, which are subdominant, fall into these potential wells created by dark matter and form galaxies in the end. And this story is in good agreement with many observational constraints, from the cosmic microwave background to large-scale structure surveys. And more. So the devil is in the details, and that's why how people now think more about this, namely that it seems that two notable details on from the astrophysical side, let's say, we know, of course, now we have the dark matter phenomenon, that we have velocity profiles of galaxies which cannot be fit by baryons only, so you need dark matter. But if you simulate a system like a Milky Way galaxy with all its satellite galaxies, you see that actually the core of many of those galaxies, especially actually for dark matter-dominated galaxies, the centers rather, are rather fitted by a core profile and not by the profile you would expect if you just have dark matter only, which would provide you a cuspy center, so a much higher dark matter density. This is referred to as the cusp core problem. And the other problem is that in CDM only simulations, let's say, you produce a lot of satellites and substructure. And if you observe how many satellite galaxies the Milky Way actually have, the biggest ones, let's say, you can't match those to the ones you actually predict because there are more of them and there are more than you see, and also those are denser than the ones you see. So, of course, people say, well, the baryons are neglected in simulations. Yeah, but these problems still are more severe for dark matter-dominated galaxies, and this is a little challenge. So from the astrophysical side, you could say what we need is a dark matter candidate, which is certainly sufficiently cold at the time structure starts to form from gravitational amplifications of linear perturbations, which is able to avoid too much clustering because you seem to produce too much structure with CDM only, and also not to be too dense in the centers of galaxies. So the dark matter candidates, very roughly I'm going through this. For CDM, we have, of course, WIMP dark matter. Most prominent and popular probably is the lightest supersymmetric particle. Its mass is about 1,000 GeV, let's say, roughly. But you can also have other scenarios where you have a higher dimensional series and the movement and the kinetic energy of such a particle is reflected in a mass in this observable universe. And depending on relic densities, you will have to think about compactification scales and all this. This gives you some idea about the mass. So WIMPs, this is, of course, one great candidate. Then another CDM candidate is the QCD axion, which is the pure number Goldstone particle, a solution to the CP problem of the strong force, which is very light in contrast to the other ones. But yet it behaves like CDM because it's a scalar and it has a quadratic potential, and so it oscillates in this potential, which gives you a behavior such like cold dark matter that the density decays like 8^-3. In order to explain some of these astrophysical subtleties I showed you before, there are scenarios where you think there may be warm dark matter because then there's a characteristic chain scale which is much bigger than for the CDM case. For CDM case, it's so small that you wouldn't really down to, you know, Earth mass scales or so. But for warm dark matter, in principle, you could think of scenarios where you be able to can suppress structure on small scales, and stereoneutrinos are very good candidate for this kind of thing if their mass is on the order of keV. As I said, you can add phenomenology, think of a hidden sector where everything conceivably can happen and can have self-interacting dark matter and composite dark matter. Many of these attempts are to have CDM on large scales, but with some notable differences so that you can explain small-scale subtleties in the CDM picture and possibly explain them. I will be focusing on what I call ultralight bosons, which are usually under the term of axion-like, but actually the thing I will be studying is not really so axion-like. And I'm just saying these are tiny masses. I'm just saying I'm bracket here range, which goes from an inverse Hubble scale to you know, below the QCD axion in terms of mass. And of course, who is to say that there's only one dark matter? There may be mixed dark matter models. Maybe we have CDM and warm dark matter. Maybe we have CDM and WIMPs and axions. No? Why not? So where do these ultralight bosons come from? I will not burn my fingers here in front of an audience which know these things much better than I do. So just briefly, for the axion-like particles, as you can already infer, it is suggested that the concept of the QCD axion is sort of generalized. You have a lot of global symmetries in unification series beyond the standard model, and if you break them spontaneously, you may also create these pure number Goldstone bosons. And given these energy scales involved, you have a mass range which is much larger than the one for the QCD axion. And also in multidimensional cosmologies, you can have some scalar fields on hidden brains which leak into our universe in a sense and give the dark matter we observe. This is very brief. Now, these ultralight bosons are described by coherent scalar field like the QCD axion, but the difference is this is really even apparent on astronomical scales because of their mass. First of all, I should say when you have scalar fields, you want to choose a potential, and of course the choice of the potential will determine cosmic evolution, as you will see also in a moment. But usually if you have something like a quadratic term or something which approximates a quadratic term, late enough you have something which behaves like CDM, which you want. But what is special here is that with this mass, you have some gene scale in the problem, which, depending on the parameters, of course, on the mass in this case, might give you just the scale you need in order to suppress small scale structure. So in this case, as I will show you, no, these scalar fields, you can write down a Klein-Gordon equation, and the non-relativistic limit of this is a Schrodinger equation, non-linear one if you have self-interaction included. And you could, in principle, then calculate what would the gravitational equilibrium of such a system look like, and you can calculate roughly a virial radius you would get. And in the case where you have no self-interaction, let's say, you could have a case where the de Broglie wavelength of your particle is of the order 1 kiloparsec. If you have self-interaction included, you could, in principle, have a higher mass and still have a virial radius of about 1 kiloparsec, because now it's the self-interaction pressure which helps you build this core size. So this has attracted the attention of astrophysicists, and this is just to show you that there's a literature where people are really interested in this, and this is not about the QCD axion, and also a lot of those papers consider scalar fields for dark matter and dark energy, mostly even dark energy, but have something to say about dark matter as well. And you can see it comes in waves, it comes and goes in waves. No? Every 10 years, no? People are interested in scalar field dark matter. So we are now in such a phase, maybe. I guess I can go further. Yeah, let's write down what do I mean with complex scalar field dark matter. I'm considering this as the only component of dark matter in the universe. And the Lagrangian is just the simple one with a quadratic and quartic potential. Before you are very confused why I'm not using natural units, this is just because we have worked previously on late time constraints on this kind of thing, and then we didn't want to change the notation. So I apologize if I throw at you H bars and C during my talk. So this has units of energy density, not the Lagrangian, and then you bear in mind that in this unit, the my coupling constant lambda is related to the dimensionless one you would usually, you know, think of like this. And yeah, this model has two fundamental parameters. It's the mass and it's the self-interaction coupling strength, which we take to be repulsive. So, and also we have a complex scalar field. So there's a U1 symmetry and particle number is conserved. So there's no self-annihilation.
Funny things with it, so just trying to understand what that means.
No, the mass is just the mass. EV is 4c squared.
Yeah, there's one over mass in the kinetic term and a single power of mass other than potential.
So usually people have ms squared, psi squared, and then there is no mass in the kinetic term. So
that's true, yeah. But in these units, you can, I mean, it's a boring exercise, but in these units, you can see that you would have, it has to have this form. Otherwise, you don't get the right dimension for the Lagrangian density.
But you could have gotten it without the mass in the denominator, I think that's really as far as
yeah, just by changing the dimensions of psi. But I guess this is the normalization usually used for non-relativistic problems.
Yeah.
So if you see,
okay.
So everybody has dimension 3 halves.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay, so different dimension of
psi.
Okay.
But apart from this boring thing, it's just the normal finite four theory. Equation of motion, as I said, Klein-Gordon equation, and we are strongly believing in GR for the time being. And what we study is just the homogeneous background evolution of a universe using the normal Friedmann-Robertson-Walker metric. But we have scalar field dark matter as opposed to other dark matter, WIMP dark matter, whatever. We do not consider perturbations also in this talk. So for the FRW metric, of course, your Klein-Gordon equation simplifies a lot, and it has the form most people are familiar with, psi double dot plus 3h psi dot plus the potential derivative with respect to psi, nice, zero. Now, for the complex field, you can no, write it in terms of amplitude and phase, and then you can just plug this thing in, and you get, of course, two equations. And the second equation can be readily integrated, and it gives you a conserved quantity, which is identified as a charge density, if you will, a conserved dark matter number, like a quantum number, a conserved number. And what it means in the end is, if you think of it in the non-relativistic limit, this charge density would correspond to the number density. So dark matter number density is conserved for complex scalar field. Also, I should already right away say, we are working in what has been called splinter sense in literature by people like, who are in principle here, I guess. Oh, he's teaching, okay. Too bad. And what that means is that most of the oscillation of our scalar field, I mean, all scalar field oscillation, is embodied in the phase, in the angular mode, and not so much in the amplitude mode, which comes down to assuming that this term is much smaller than this one. Again, FRW gives you the Friedmann equation. It's very, very easy. And we have radiation, we have baryons. We have scalar field dark matter, which we don't know a priori how it will behave. That's why we have to calculate it. And for the dark energy, we just adopt the cosmological constant. Now, for the homogeneous background evolution, of course, the scalar field depends on the time, which simplifies things tremendously, as many of you know. The energy momentum tens is diagonal, and you can adopt the perfect fluid description. Now, if you do that, you can write T mu like this, and the energy density rho and the pressure P is just the sum of these terms. This is just standard or everything here. Now, as I say, the basic behavior is oscillation, and we have to calculate this correctly. However, you can identify some limit cases, in a sense, where you can already see how the scalar field behaves in principle. So there is an important case distinction, namely, when is the oscillation in the phase with respect to Hubble rate high or small? And if it's high, it's fast oscillation, and you can back to the Klein-Gordon equation and drop the Hubble term and can calculate the dispersion relation, so to say, which gives you omega like this. And unsurprisingly, if you have no self-interaction lambda, this is just omega's m. If in this fast oscillation regime, you cannot really track the evolution of scalar field exactly because it's not feasibly, it's numerically not feasibly. So you have to average, as people usually do. What you do is you average over many oscillation periods and you consider the averaged energy density and average pressure, which come down to these expressions. And you can also connect them in order to sort of derive an equation of state which relates the two. In this way. So in this fast oscillation regime, that's actually most of the Hubble time, as we will see.
Is that equation of state usually matter-like?
No, Well, if lambda is zero, yes. As I will in the next slide, this equation state describes actually two cases. These. So right. So if of course, once the universe expands enough that the mass term dominates, you have the W zero. No, I mean the average value and pressure averages to zero, and you have normal CDM-like behavior where rho goes like h minus 3. Now, we have this quartic term. So if you go back in time, there will be a time where this takes over. And then your equation of state is radiation-like. And then scalar field dark matter evolves like radiation. That means it goes like h minus, rho decays like h minus 4. And I should, of course, say if you have no quartic term, then you don't have this radiation-like phase. For example, if you consider normal axion and you neglect self-interaction, you usually wouldn't have encountered such a thing. And that's just to show you know how the thing oscillates. This is a look back time of what, half a year or so, and the pressure averages around zero as it should. And now, in the other extreme case, where the oscillation of phase over A over Hubble expansion is much smaller than one, there is a regime which is called in literature stiff phase normally. So what happens here is the equation of state instead of stiff matter, meaning W is 1, P goes like rho, and the energy density decays like h minus 6, a thing which has also been called kination by Michael Joyce. I should say this phase cannot be avoided for complex scalar fields because we have this kinetic term which dominates here, has two contributions. One is from the amplitude, the one you're used to maybe, the phi dot squared, and one is from the phase term. And if we associate the conserved charge with the current dark matter density, which we know, I mean, up to errors, but then we can see that this term would then actually dominate over the potential, and there's no way out from this point of view. So this is just a sort of limit cases, a proc. Excuse me, I guess I didn't hear.
So I might worry in that limit that just taking an FRW universe and not taking the time varying back reaction of the scalar field,
it's
going to break down.
These are subtleties I've not thought about. If it's about back reaction, yeah, I don't know. I would not think so, just for the fact that I've seen a lot of papers thinking about such models and not being worried. This is just, but it's an interesting point, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe we should worry about that. Okay, this was a qualitative statement now. Now we just want to calculate it. And so you just take the parameters, cosmological parameters from, let's say, the recent Planck results. And what we do is we replace omega cold dark matter. Our omega cold dark matter is scalar field dark matter. And all the other parameters are as usual. And we assume standard model neutrinos are massless, so our omega lambda is just the difference of cold dark matter as a matter and radiation, total matter and radiation. And this is just a technical point how we do it. As I said, we have this we have this many oscillations, we have to average, and we do this up to a certain epoch. And at a point where we are still in the fast oscillation regime, we stop doing the averaging and have to calculate it exactly until the back to the Big Bang, so to say. And this has to be done in a way that the late time and an early time solution match in a way, which is sort of a technical point, but just to mention it. And you can do this for different choices of your particle parameters, mass, coupling, strength, and handle the other components as usual. So I'm throwing at you our fiducial model here. This is the model which I will show when I show you the plots. So unsurprisingly, this will be a model which fits all the constraints I will show you. So, no. So this has a mass of 3 × 10⁻²⁰ eV. It has a coupling constant of about 10⁻⁵ in physical units. And what is will be important is that in some constraints, actually only the ratio lambda by m squared will be important, which for these values just is 2 × 10⁻¹⁸. Just to remind you, this is a small coupling constant. It's true. If you see what that looks in natural units, it's tiny, 10⁻⁷. And just for your comparison's sake, for the QCD axion, that lambda would look like 10⁻⁵. So you are actually really pushing hard here on the 20 orders of magnitude or so lower. And yet, as we will see, the model behaves different if you have a lambda or don't have a lambda. This is amazing given the small number, actually. So this is the evolution of scalar field dark matter energy density as a function of scale factor. And as you can see, late it behaves like cold dark matter, as it should. It goes over in the radiation-like phase at some point, and earlier it goes to a stiff phase. Now, already here's a constraint involved because we know from the CMB power spectrum when when matter radiation equality happened. So we better want to make sure that our model is sufficiently cold by the time this happens. And that's what this cross for that model indeed does. This is just to illustrate again that, well, actually, this is maybe a technical thing which I can defer if there's a question. Yeah, and let's plot now the omegas, no, the energy density fractions of cosmic inventory as a function of scale factor. So you have radiation in red. The lambda, our cosmological constant, kicks in only late, of course. Baryons are also just subdominant. And the blue line is the dark matter, scalar field dark matter. And this is the normal behavior you would expect. But here, since it's behaving radiation-like, there's an offset, so to say. And here kicks in the transition to the stiff phase. So it takes over, and at some point, it will be the dominant component in the universe over radiation.
So are those constraints because you know you can't have too much extra radiation?
Yes, right. That's what my next point was. Here is again the redshift of matter radiation equality from CMB. And here, of course, is BBN. And BBN is our favorite child to constrain things at least that early. And I will say more about it in a minute. Now, as I said, we have this quadratic term. We have self-interaction. And as you can see from this plot, which plots the W versus scale factor, you can see that the larger lambda by m squared is, actually the ratio is more is the determining thing, the longer lasts the radiation-like phase. I mean, this is lambda, and it gives rise to the radiation-like phase. And if you increase this ratio, you're just pushing hard on this end. It ends sort of later here. And you're also pushing hard on this end. So the transition also happens later.
Sorry, why is air quality fixed here? Yeah, because, of course, if you have more radiation, if it's acting like radiation for longer, you're actually going to have
yeah, more. But the thing is, yeah, right. Actually, what we do, we fix, we don't want to screw anything on the measured C quality. So we say we have C quality from CMB, and we want to make sure that scalar field dark matter is cold before that.
I think like kind of maybe the point you're making is that in a cosmology where you vary delta around the fact that the best fit value for a quality changes.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can't just keep a quality fixed and vary an effective
yeah, yeah.
because the best fit's different.
Yeah, yeah. I will talk more about an effective, right.
It seems to me that your mass is very small.
It is.
So in order to connect to data, lambda has to be very small.
Right.
But it's so small, it's so unnaturally small compared to everything we know in physics.
Yeah.
Doesn't this trouble you?
Not really.
Why not?
Because for two reasons. First, I see a lot of particle theorists who have philosophical discussion about naturalness and may not take it, may have down points on it. On the other hand, I could say I'm an astrophysicist, I'm much more pragmatic. I could say I take a model and study its phenomenology without knowing how its embedding in a more fundamental theory will really, that will all work out readily. It is a small number, that's true, but you know, the QC axis is also a small number. Is that natural, or is this more natural than this one? I don't know.
You can never measure interactions.
No, I'm not, and this is not about how to possibly detect those particles, which there are ideas, mainly depends on the form of particle. This is really just how would it look like cosmologically, and how would we constrain it, and what could it predict what another model could not, and or maybe it's ruled out by some reason.
As long as this is bigger than -120, then it's natural.
Dark matter is invisible, which is what bothers us. We don't see it.
Right.
But you say gravitation. Yeah.
You're making the interactions invisible too.
No.
It's
not
if you have a
prediction
for another number, which they said you have.
It has to couple gravitationally, no, of course, otherwise. It has its impact on the universe. No? On
when the M are both small, it's technically natural. All the graphs are suppressed by lambda.
I have to accept that. Now I have to object.
you asked, is the QCD axion natural? And I think that's, you've answered that right there. It's more natural, isn't it? There's naturalness, which is aesthetic, but then there's technical naturalness, such as a very precise criterion, which you could argue you don't want.
But this is then about fine-tuning, isn't it? Then the question is it fine-tuned, my model?
Well, so the issue is, can you embed this into an ultraviolet completion, and do you regard that as an important clue to the whole problem? Which you don't have to, right? You just take a point of view that you don't believe that that's...
Well, it's not that I don't care.
But
like
once you have, then the QCD axion is natural in that sense. And so then the question would be, could you do this with an axion kind of a model?
Sure. No, don't get me wrong. I'm really interested if somebody can do it, and I'm sad if not.
And the second thing is that it's not fair to take a bunch of small scales and say it's natural, because what makes these things hard is always that we know that there's particle physics around that has to exist, and that's not small scales. And the question is always about how does the stuff you're doing couple to the stuff we know?
I know.
And that's what drives that.
Right. But of course, on this level, it's...
I know that you didn't say that, so I'm done.
Right, yeah. Yeah, right, thanks. So, of course, I mean, this Lagrangian also, it's a low effective Lagrangian of something which I don't know. That's fair.
When you look for WIMPs, the xenon 100 or whatever, you give them a big mass, you're supposed to be seeing.
Yeah, but this is a different particle.
But here, you can only infer everything from gravity here.
Right.
Always.
Right.
So This is one of the problems of the dark matter business.
Yeah, it's all trouble.
Gravity.
I mean, the dark matter business is a trouble business. Sure, but suppose nobody finds a WIMP for another 10 years or 20 years. Then we are clueless. So if we have some other candidates around which can do something reasonable, it makes sense. Sure, if they find a WIMP tomorrow, great. And I don't waste my postdoc life on this. Maybe so, but I'm assuming general relativity is correct. So that's my presumption.
Isn't there some notion of coherent length that you have to be worried about? You're assuming some homogeneity or something you can do.
Well, the equation of state for a background is always about homogeneous background.
Now you are in matter era and you are having nonlinear evolution, then so why your calculation should be breaking down.
Right, I mean,
gradient terms or something like that.
This is really only about the background. And in fact, if you go into a nonlinear regime of structure formation, again, the quadratic term makes some role in the sense that it provides you with self interaction pressure in a way on small scale. But this phenomenon is only visible on small scales. and it wouldn't affect the equation of state on large scales. It's like the baryons. You can have baryons have huge thermal pressure in galaxy clusters, and yet the equation of state is zero, no, on a global and a cosmological scale.
I mean, the case of baryon, because the nature of baryon, but the, when you're having just one scalar field and doing this every calculation and expanding around that background value, is it, is there?
Well, there,
I don't know how
there is no expansion of something. I'm sorry, there's no expansion in powers of, I mean, there's no derivations here.
So how do I separate the like the nonlinear part of the scalar field from the background evolution in this?
Well, it's always as you do CDM. No? What is, I mean, well, I see, maybe you're, oh, I see, maybe you're concerned there's some.
Background is not
valid
anymore. That
position is not valid. Yeah, I see. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you are concerned with more subtle one. Yeah, I don't know. I would need to see the term. I'm not sure I understand.
I think
more.
Maybe something I would say about the Flatland situation is that there are two different questions. One is the perturbation theory in the field, and the other is perturbation theory in density and pressure.
Right.
And the two aren't necessarily equivalent to each other because the field, the phase could actually become very different from the background because it oscillates very, very fast. So even it's 1% different from the background value, over a Hubble time it could be orders of magnitude different from the phase because it does oscillate.
I see,
right?
Yeah.
But the density and pressure, which are the physical quantities,
yes,
they may still be
right.
Linear.
So
and
that's
one
true.
Is for phase,
yeah.
One is for
yeah.
Yeah.
So I think probably the proper way to do it is you have to write some effective equation of a state for the system, and then deal with perturbation theory of density and pressure, or whatever the right quantities are.
Yeah.
You shouldn't do it in the field, because probably that the perturbation theory for that breaks down pretty quickly.
Yeah. Actually, we encountered difficulties on this. Maybe we can talk more on this. Yeah, but yeah, these values are not encoded here. We're really just saying that we have the background and as I say, this equation of state I showed you before is sort of also in a certain limit is true, and otherwise has to be calculated more carefully. So as I said, the constraint from the mass radiation equality by saying that we fix the equality from CMB and we want that this scalar field of matter morphs into CDM before.
They are transiting from stiff to radiation around EVN. That is a bit weird.
Yeah, I will talk all about in detail about this.
Okay.
So this is the other constraint, okay, on mass radiation equality, and this has been pointed out in literature before, sometimes more like, you know, without constraining the parameters, but of course this is a known fact. And what you can do is you can, it actually comes down to constraining the ratio of lambda m squared. And what you have, here's a little tricky part, how much cold is cold. If you fix this W to be 0.001 and say this is, we consider this as being fully realistic, non-realistic, sorry, then this is the bound you get. If you relax this, you get a slightly less conservative bound. For this to be more precise, one would need to calculate the CMB power spectrum for a given scalar field dark matter model and see which range of them preserves the early integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect, which depends on the C quality. So this is a thing for the future. This is just a reminder again, I guess. Now comes BBN. So now, in the lambda CDM model with standard model neutrinos only, the standard value for the number of effective number of realistic degrees of freedom for neutrinos is 3.046. So, of course, every relativistic component which would be around the BBN would speed up the expansion rate because of the additional energy density in radiation or realistic degrees of freedom, rather. this is what we mean with ineffective. So everything which is above this standard value you would expect if you had no extra degree of freedom is an extra value, delta ineffective, let's say. And therefore, you also know that that this helps to constrain your parameters if you consider the number of realistic degrees of freedom at the time of PBN. Now, normally, if you have a model and maybe you introduce some extra realistic degree of freedom, like sterile neutrinos, and you take a constant portion of them, and then you have a fixed number of whatever ineffective. Now, in our model, we've seen that the equation of state changes. So delta ineffective in our model changes because it has a stiff phase, and then it's a radiation-like phase. And so we have to study evolution of it throughout BBN, which
I guess what you're saying is that even though it's 8 to the minus 6, it's not radiation. But the constraint for BBN is a constraint on the expansion rate.
Right, that's
it's
what
it
is.
It's not a constraint on stuff that goes as 8
no,
to the minus 4.
No.
It's a constraint on what is H.
Yes.
I guess
which
that's
is related to the scattering.
Well, I think it's quite interesting because you then have, you know, typically there are constraints on ineffective, or as you say, basically it's just the expansion rate, right? At BBN, and then you have constraints on ineffective at the CMV. And of course, if you're fixing quality at the CMV, you're like artificially placing constraint on ineffective at the CMV. Not artificially, but you know, that's a constraint that you've added. And so,
yeah, we'll see in a few graphs also that, yeah, right. And notably, you should not have, I mean, our ineffective at the time of matter ratio should be the standard one,
exactly.
Right? So BBN, we bracket this era of BBN by two epochs, let's say. One is the beginning of neutron-proton freeze-out, around 1.293 MeV, which is ANP. And the other later epoch is the beginning of nuclear production, which is basically deuterium, around about 0.07 MeV, which is a nuke. This is sort of the bracketing epochs in a scale factor, which you remember from the other slide, but I can show you again. So again, we have no extra neutrinos, sterile neutrinos, anything. If there's any delta ineffective, it's coming from the scale of field dark matter. It's the only source here. And we parameterize it by using the energy density, which gives rise to the higher expansion in that case. And we compare this to the ineffective we just take from the literature from what is now considered sort of the bound on ineffective from BBN, from primordial abundances, rather. So as I just said, we take the ineffective from the Steigman paper, which sort of summarizes a lot of recent things, and which is basically from primordial abundance measurements. And it's a central value of 3.71. And I am also including the one sigma error bar here, and this corresponds to delta nu of this. Now, this is just a graph to see this again. This is the baryon fraction here. This is the delta ineffective. This plot does not assume any lepton asymmetry or so. So this is just set to zero. And you can see that this ineffective sort of, it pushes a little to one here, so it's not here down at zero. So the one sigma bound is sort of above it, but of course a delta ineffective of zero is in accordance with the BBN constraint to two sigma. Anyway, we are conservative and just say we want our delta ineffective, or ineffective rather, be all the time within this one sigma confidence limit. This is just a choice we make. We could say two sigma, but just a choice. Now, again, this is the thing you've seen already. These are the two epochs I just told you, neutron-proton freeze-out here, nuclear reduction here. And these lines are the values I just showed you. This red line is the central value of 3.71, and the one sigma error bars are the yellow ones. And why this little tip here, you can see this is a technical problem because at that time there is electron positron annihilation, so the photons get some extra kick, extra energy here. So this is why it's not a straight line, but it's technically a point. So, and here you see already in a aphorism fiducial model, this thing goes through here. So it's not up here, it's not down here. So it's lying in this bound. Now let's zoom in and say in more detail again, remind yourself, here's the radiation-like phase of scalar field dark matter. And here's this stiff, and here it goes up to a stiff phase. Here's the transition, so to say. And the plateau is when it's radiation-like. And now, what does that mean? When it's on the plateau, we can actually calculate analytically what the ineffective there would correspond in terms of omega scalar field dark matter. And this bound I showed you before just translates into a bound on the amount of scalar field dark matter you can have in order to not screw up this bound. This is assuming that the scalar field dark matter reaches this plateau before the time of nuclear production, meaning that it flattens out sort of here, and not just later and after this epoch, but really before that epoch, which is again a choice, but a reasonable one. Now, the higher lambda of m squared, again, the surface direction coupling, the higher the plateau, that gives you a constraint on lambda of m squared again. Because if your plateau is too high, you're pushing up here and you would get out of this bound from BBN. So you have an upper and lower bound on lambda of m squared from an effective during BBN, which is, yeah, fairly narrow. No, I mean, maybe uncomfortably narrow in a sense, three orders of magnitude, something like that. But that's what it is. Now, this is one thing, but it's not only a constraint on lambda of m squared, actually, what we get. Because the transition to stiff phase, which comes about due to the dominance of the kinetic term, and we know the mass comes in the kinetic term, it's in the end also a constraint on the mass. So here are two graphs. This is the expansion rate in our model over the expansion rate in lambda CDM as comparison. You see the numbers are larger than one here. As a function of scale factor for two different cases. This is a case where lambda of m squared is the same. So they all level out on the same plateau here. But the mass is different. So the solid line is our fiducial model. And if you take a higher mass, you are up here. And if you take a lower mass, you are down here. And this, so that's saying you have to make sure that this stiff phase doesn't, I mean, that this transition, rather, to the stiff phase doesn't happen too early, which gives you a lower bound on the particle mass. And here is the same graph, but we fix now the mass, fiducial model, the same mass, 3 times 10 to the 21. But we vary lambda of m squared, and you can see the level to different values. No? The plateau has different values because lambda of m squared is different. And this, I just repeat this graph sort of here, but I'm now plotting the effective neutrino number, no? Which is, of course, constant in the for the Steigman bound no? we're using, which is, again, the same colors, and the same models here plotted. And in addition to that, I'm giving you as comparison the ineffective from CMB using only the you know the CMB alone, so no prior on H or not.
So this,
or
goes, so. this goes back to what I was saying earlier. I think you know I understand that you want to fix a quality, so effectively you're fixing ineffective CMB. But I think that you're actually, because you have such a strong lever arm here, you're actually making this transition much steeper, right? As you can see from that dash curve. If you'd allowed there to be some variation in ineffective at the CMB, you wouldn't necessarily need to have such a steep drop.
But the thing is, this is fixed by lambda of m squared, let's say. So you are right. I could say lambda of m squared shouldn't be in conflict with the CMB and effective either.
Yeah.
But that does not yet tell you how this transition happens. You know, this is, you see, for, let's see, this is the case. Let's see, this is the same lambda of m squared. Suppose I fix that. Then I could still have a transition which is happening earlier, which is happening later. And if it's just happening too early, it still may screw up my BBN.
No, exactly. But I just think then those constraints are coming like themselves rather than imposing one very tight constraint at the CNB and then letting the BBN.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a choice.
Yeah. I mean, in the end, it turns out that, of course, yeah, but of course the model parameters matter. No? If you had different model parameters and you are not within this error bar, that's a problem too. No? I mean, you can see that the central values of the CMB here, no? Let's say from the value compared to the one from BBN, is in accordance, no? Within one sigma. No? So they're not heavily in conflict. But you could say there is, currently at least, it seems that BBN gives you more an effect if that CMB. That's what.
It should be relevant because, let me tell you why. Because this is supposed to be your cold dark matter, right? So it should actually get cold by the time that you see the CMB. Otherwise,
yes, yeah, that's ridiculous. Right, that's the constraint from C quality. Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
In the sense they're taking the constraint to be stronger, they're not allowing the large variation in effective at the CMB.
At the
right.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm saying that you can weaken. You can actually give yourself more freedom and you're saying you don't want to, which
yeah,
is fine.
No, we are more conservative, yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, we say it should be cold, really, and actually...
Yeah.
So that ineffective at the CMB would actually be zero.
Yeah, exactly. It would be consistent,
yeah.
It would be consistent with zero.
Yeah, yeah. So that means you haven't... Exactly.
Yeah, right.
You're just being more conservative than that one.
Yeah. So if you collect all these bounds I've shown you and draw the parameter space of particle mass, and here is lambda of m squared, you can see the regions of exclusion. Now, this is the line coming from C quality. We want to have it cold, or cold. So everything here is forbidden, so we are on this side of the plot. And these two color curves are those which say you force an effective to be within this one sigma limit at the time of nuclear reaction, which gives you this one sigma sort of curve. And this one says an effective shall be within the one sigma limit even at the time of neutron proton freeze out, which is an earlier epoch, and therefore gives you a tighter constraint than the later epoch constraint would give you. If you want to fulfill all those constraints, you're finding yourself in this region here, in this cross-hatched region. And our fiducial model is just sitting here, so it's in within it. And if you believe it and say, I want to be conservative about it all and really say this is it, you can see two things. First, you have a lower bound on the mass. Apparently, no, you cannot go too low with the particle mass. No, you have a lower bound here. And second, it appears, if you take this an effective from BBN as it is now, that you would need a self-interaction. Because if your model is on self-interaction, it relies on this axis only, and it's not in this exclusion. I mean, it's not in this allowed region. Yeah?
I don't think that's a bad comparison of models because they have different numbers of parameters.
Sure, right, we had discussion.
So if you take the lambda equals zero model with delta and effective, and the two and both models have the same number of parameters and fit just as well, then the data is inconclusive. Unless you then say, okay, actually this effective, you know, it's a varying delta effective, and you redo the BBN,
right.
It proves the constraint.
Yeah, no, sure.
Significant measure.
Yeah, I mean, what would be...
You have to say which one actually fits.
Right.
Better.
It would
comparing
be...
The
yes,
both,
I mean...
Comparing the models in a fair way.
Right. It would be, of course, also necessary to really do a BBN calculation using our model, let's say. No? You
yeah,
take
exactly.
A BBN code and you
yeah,
calculate...
You actually improve the fit over...
Right. That would
the
be
standard
the,
model with delta effective.
Yeah. That would be the best thing to do.
Yeah.
What we do here is just take a limit from literature and and be conservative about it. That's all. I show you, well, if you had no self-interaction, I want to show you how the cosmic evolution looks like. This is more or less the same, except that, of course, in that case, you have no radiation-like phase. So you have cold dark matter here, and you have the stiff phase here. So using... And you can see that, of course, you have to also have the bound on the mass because you have this transitional stiff phase. So you can, of course, fulfill BBN. But suppose you would need to be inside this thing. This is my point. Then you would need a finite lambda to be in there. if the constraint from BBNs comes down, no, or then actually then it's the other way around. If it came down, then you would have troubles with the model with self-interaction because you may maybe not be in the allowed region anymore.
But if you added in delta n effective, there was the right amount from the CMB, because you've got delta n effective zero at the CMB. If you add in just delta n effective, the same amount that you need at CMB, that would raise you up, and you would also, you know, that would actually be a better thing.
Yeah.
So you would then want to say the CMB and you would then.
Yeah, sure. But I mean, this again, and this assumes there's only scalar field dark matter without self-interaction, no extra neutrino, nothing else, you see? Nothing else. Right, but I should say again that this is sort of a lower bound, no, on the, this plateau value is sort of is actually an upper bound of the ineffective of scalar field dark matter ever since, no, then in the evolution. It is just that here is it higher, and here we have to constrain it also more probably, but, what we are, of course, well, anyway, I'm coming to this. I'm almost done here. Well, now I'm making a big circle because I talked about small-scale structure problems for galaxies in the beginning. What had that to do? Well, actually, one can show that for a model we are interested in, where the self-interaction is somewhat important, that the minimum size of a virialized object can be calculated, and it depends on lambda of m squared also. I didn't show you that, but you have to believe me for the time being. That means we can relate the virial size of these objects to the ineffective, which also depends on lambda of m squared in the radiation-like phase, and I told you. So we can draw a diagram where we have the core radius in kiloparsec, let's say, versus ineffective, and the yellow thing is again the bound from C equality. The two dotted are from BBN. The green is from the Planck's CMB. And our fiducial model sits in here. So, again, what that means, what that shall suggest is, of course, higher ineffective would imply stronger self interaction pressure because lambda of m squared is higher, and hence a larger minimum scale for dark matter structure. So, for this fiducial model, it appears that you can fulfill the BBN bounds if you take them as we did, which, well, this is the lower bound from BBN. I should be more careful now. This is the upper bound from C equality, which is actually a better upper bound than the upper bound from BBN. This is the lower bound on the mass again, 2.4 times 10 minus 21. And actually, this bound on lambda of m squared translates directly into this bound on the core size of smallest object you can form in this model, which is between 0.75 and 5.2 kiloparsec. So it's surprisingly that actually it turns out that this bound is really within the range of the 1 kiloparsec roughly, where you see these deviations from, or the problems of CDM, where you think there may be a core or another cusp or.
If the upper bound comes from Z equality, that means that this dark matter is really relativistic up until equality, basically, right? Or down until equality. So then you don't form anything that's smaller than any structure that is smaller than the size of the horizon at equality, which is, I don't know, 300
kiloparsec. Yeah. This number, I mean, I wouldn't take that too serious. First of all, it would be too large for astrophysic purposes. No, this would really just be if you took the formula I haven't proved to you and you plug in the lambda of m squared of the upper bound.
That's plugging in the gene scale, it's not actually counting for the real growth that you would get with saying I complete this gene scale, assuming I have formed the bound structure.
Uh-huh.
But as you were saying, if you actually had that much delta effective in the actual evolution of the linear growth, you would never form the bound structure.
But you're right, there is a suddenly that you say you maybe taking the marginal case with just morphs, and certainly you would.
Calculation.
Right. No, there's no way around it. There's no way around it. Sure. No. As I say, this upper bound is more fluffy and it's less interesting. It's more about the lower bound because that would suggest that you would not have structure smaller than this. Of course, this is all subject to current measurements in the sense of the ineffective from BBN I showed you and the CMB bounds. And these are just a few conclusions. I guess I'm already running out of time. I have more slides for discussion, but never mind. So just briefly, complex scalar field dark matter on a cosmological scale seems to be fine if you constrain the parameters accordingly, as we have done. Work is in progress to study structure formation, which may it all rule out, because linear and nonlinear structure formation is highly non-trivial, and it may be a problem, but we will see. So we constrain the allowed parameter space severely compared to the previous literature, even by considering only the evolution background universe, especially if the BBN thing was a surprise to us. I mean, the thing with C equality was acknowledged previously, but BBN thing hasn't been considered so much. There remains, even with these conservative bounds I showed you, there remains a semi-infinite stripe in the parameter space, which is in accordance with current observations, including parameter sets which are able to resolve the small scale problems of CDM, meaning you may have smaller structure of the order of 1 kiloparsec and suppress overclustering and all this. This is, as I say, if you take these conservative bounds, you could say if it stands, if it keeps standing, that the ineffective during BBN is higher than the standard value, that would rule out the possibility of a scalar field of matter without self-interaction, because you would not be able to explain it unless you introduce new components to your model. Also, since ineffective during BBN is higher than the one at CMB naturally, because the way it seems a nice explanation for this fact. And I guess I should stop here because I'm already guessing. Thank you very much.
I have one more, going back, following your post on the additional parameters. So you've got one more parameter than the other that much.
Sure.
So what you really need to do to say, you can accommodate having a higher value of delta effective because you've got one more parameter. But you really need to do the statistics on this and say, do I improve delta chi-square by more than one?
Yeah, right? And
I mean, if you don't improve delta chi-square by more than one, then you've just introduced a parameter and you've just, it could be that parameter.
On this level, it's just like saying, sort of disfavored, but I mean, you see,
it's possible to accommodate.
Yeah.
But there's no statistical significance to ruling out or not in this.
And it's also what just the one sigma, a confidence limit you took. Yeah. I mean, you could say, this is sort of very conservative.
But it's not even one sigma unless you redo the fits, if the physics is different.
It's
not just degenerate with the physics.
Right, but one thing I would want to claim still that if you had only this kind of dark matter, nothing else, and you would have an ineffective from BBN,
But even introducing the lambda and moving the line up, does that improve delta chi square by?
I would claim it, but I haven't done it. But yeah, it would be good to do that.
Any more questions?
I've got a short comment. I think when you put a stiff radiation era before BBN. I wonder if you consider that you need to arrange that together with your inflation
history,
and the reheating, of course.
Right.
Now, just go.
Now we're getting into devil's kitchen.
It will be all right.
It is true. I have only recently started to think about it. I mean, I was aware that how should that work out with inflation earlier? I don't know. It's interesting. I have seen some literature which previously had some motivation even to have a stiff phase. For example, this one, Joyce and Brokovich, 1998. Their motivation is a completely different one. They say they want to accomplish baryogenesis at the electric scale, even so it's not of a first order phase transition. And what they're doing, they sort of reformulate the Svalbard bound and a bound on the expansion rate. And they can devise a model where if you had a scalar field which scales like this, you could accomplish baryogenesis without a problem. And then they go into discussion, yeah, how could it be actually that you could have a kinetic energy dominated scalar field?
That you could easily accommodate.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I haven't thought about it yet. It would be interesting. For the real field case, what people usually study, you have to think about what potential you need, as you mentioned it. For the complex field, it's not so clear to me, because in the sense, and I'm now putting under the rug all the discussion we had about how natural initial conditions are and how they map onto the boundary condition in the late universe. Here it seems, well, you anyway get it. I mean, we take this 5^4 potential, which is a nice potential, and you don't have to deal with the potential in this case. So it would be interesting to see how you can really implement this complex field, sort of match it onto an inflation in a more thorough way. But yeah, that's a good thing to think about. Thanks, yeah.
Okay, any more questions? Before we thank Tanya again, as usual, we'll be going to dinner in the bistro at 6. Postdocs and students will be catered for it again, as usual. So hope to see you there, and let's thank Tanya again.
Thank you.